things are getting a lot more interesting, both federally and at the state level. And we'll talk to you all about it next. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with us today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, Barry, it's great to be back with you in our respective studios today. Well, I'm looking outside. It's a beautiful day, and it's about 14 degrees. So if you recall, last week we talked about the weather, and I expressed doubt that we were going to get quite as much snow as everybody was worried about. Well, guess what? I was wrong.
Oops.
We did get a lot of rain, and I mean a lot of rain, but then on top of that, got a lot of snow because I had to dig out on Saturday to go into town. I would rather have not, but I have professional obligations with my business, and I had to go ship some stuff. So I had to run to the post office, and it took us a good 40 minutes to dig out. And I want to thank my neighbor, even though I don't think he listens to our radio show, but I'll give kudos to him. He came over. He has a 1962 Ford tractor with a rear scraper on it, of which, yes, I am somewhat jealous. I'd like to have one. And he scraped my driveway out without me even asking him. He and I had helped someone who was a complete stranger to both of us. He's a good Christian man. He and his wife are quite young, have young little children. And we had gotten together to help a man who was stuck on our road, had a car so light he couldn't get up the hill. Well, what we had to do was I had to go into the house and get kitty litter and spread it under his wheels so he could get up the hill on the road in front of our house. So,
yeah, no doubt.
I think he appreciated that. He didn't know for sure whether I would, you know, he understood that I was just doing it, and I'm an old guy, and I was out there helping pushing this guy out of the ditch. And we got him out and got that fellow out and running, and he came over and cleaned out my driveway. So I'm very deeply appreciative.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, it's good to have good neighbors. That's for sure.
No kidding. It's great to have good neighbors.
That's always a great thing. And you're right. You underpredicted the weather, but that's okay, because from what I'm looking at over the weekend, it looks like we're warming up enough that most of that snow and probably the ice will be melting off. So,
well, we'll give thanks to the Lord
to
for that as well.
In a temperate zone.
Yes. Well, we give thanks to the Lord for that as well. One thing I've noticed this year is that we are about 4 weeks ahead of schedule. For instance, normally what we get is we'll get a freeze in mid-December, and then around Christmas time, it's like 55 degrees. So all the kids are like,
oh, yeah,
going,
exactly.
No white Christmas this year. Well, we did have a white Christmas this year because it got cold about the middle of December, and it stayed cold until we had that snap where it got up to around 60, 2 weeks ago or 10 days ago?
And
it
got about a week and a half ago.
And it got up to 60, and all the snow and ice completely disappeared. And within just a few days, it was back with a vengeance. So it's the old saying, everybody complains about the weather and nobody does anything about it. Well, we haven't done anything about it because we can't.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, because God's the one who does everything with the weather. We just our job's just to complain about it, I guess.
That's right.
Or move to somewhere where we think the weather's better, but after we live there for a while, we realize they have weather too. It's just a different type of yuck.
I was going to say, my mother through the fall season has to sit there and worry about hurricanes. Now, West Palm Beach went something like 35 years without a hurricane, and then all of a sudden they came through like five in succession. So the last big one down there, which I don't remember the name of that one, that might have been Irma, it looked like a Cat 5 headed smack dab for where she was in West Palm Beach. And at the last minute, it took a left-hand turn and hooked up and hit Central Florida, the Orlando area. And it had slowed down to about a Cat 4 or Cat 3 by that time, but it looked like it was going to hit Cat 5 in West Palm Beach, where my mom is. That could have been really, 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 really ugly. So we give thanks to the Lord for his mercies on that kind of thing. You know, we sit here and worry about blizzards on this end and tornadoes in the spring, and they worry about hurricanes for about 8 months.
Yeah, I think we've got a much better trade-off.
Yeah, and in the Southwest, what do they worry about? Well, they worry about flash floods during the rainy season.
Flash floods, and depending on where you are, brush fires.
Yes, brush fires. I watched a guy who had never seen a flash flood before standing there with a camera, and you could hear the flash flood coming down the gully. You could hear it coming, hear it coming, hear it coming. Oh, gosh, must have been over a minute. You could hear and then all of a sudden this thing shows up, and the guy's a little too close to the gully. I wouldn't have been that close. But here comes this rush of water, deep water, and with all this debris in it, bits of trees and just stuff drug along by this water running about 45 miles an hour. You see why people get killed out there. So everybody has weather issues.
Oh, sure.
You can't go any place in the world where there isn't a weather issue that everybody's worried about. Sure hope we don't have one of those things.
Well, it's nice to know that some things haven't changed. I hear some people, especially younger people, talk about how this is the worst winter I think I've ever seen. And I have to sit and laugh because then I go, 1978, 1993.
Okay, that now you've hit upon something which makes it the reason why you can sell the global warming hoax to young people.
Yes, exactly. You anticipated where I'm headed.
Yes, I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, please go right ahead.
Okay.
Because it's funny because, you know, and even it isn't just young people, Chuck. I mean, I've got a number of other adults who are like, oh, this is the worst winter. I'm like, okay, where did you live at before in the Southeast Asia somewhere in the islands? Because this is the way winters used to be when I was a kid. Deep cold snaps and lots of snow and... You didn't have 60 and 70 degree weathers on Christmas Day.
No.
You know, you had 15 and 20 degree weather on Christmas Day. You went sledding. I mean, it's like the weather's finally getting back around to normalizing again. Either that or what I experienced as a child was completely abnormal. And
well,
that became my normal because that's the way I
That's the problem. That's the problem you have. You know, we always say, well, we've broken a record high temperature and therefore it's warmer. I'm like, well, now wait a minute. Records go back to about the 1880s, maybe.
Right.
And exactly. A lot of cases, not that far back. Weather is cyclic. Has it ever been hotter in Ohio than like 97 degrees on such and such a date? Well, we know back to the mid-1800s. Before that, we don't have any idea.
Oh, it's all guesswork at that point.
They can supposedly do some detective work with tree rings and that kind of thing. And I always laugh when... If you know anything about aging things by tree rings, it's majorly problematic because if you go through, for instance, a wet spring and a really dry summer and then a wet fall before the leaves fall, you can get two or three rings on a tree, growth rings. Now, they can mm-hmm. usually tell if they're further apart or closer together, blah, 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 how long the... But very often, you can get more than one set of growth rings in a year. So, truly dating a tree by growth rings, And it also depends on the kind of tree. Slow growers, not so much. Fast growers, you can, poplar trees and that kind of thing. Some maples, you might get two or three growth rings in a year. Some of this detective work to go back and tell you temperatures, it doesn't work out so well. This is why when people are doing some research and trying to claim that there was the temperatures were this at this period and that at another period, you don't have any real idea.
Yeah.
Man, I always laugh at that. They keep telling us it's warmer now than it ever has been. And I'm laughing. I go, you know, you shut down all the land-based temperature stations in Siberia. What does it do to the average temperature of the earth that you're relying on these temperature stations?
Maybe it rises a little?
Yes, it rises a lot. What's the coldest place on Earth? I mean, besides the poles, outside of the polar regions.
Outside of the polar regions, the coldest place on Earth, I think, is a place called International Falls, Minnesota, if you just pay attention to the American media.
That's the coldest place on the American continent. It ain't got
right.
nothing on Siberia.
Right.
Siberia just had minus 88 Fahrenheit. That is cold. That's a direct pipeline from the pole, and it has to do with the size of the land mass and where the oceans are and all kinds of stuff. But that air blows down off the pole, and then it ends up kind of creeping over to Canada and Alaska, and it blows down here as what we call Alberta Clipper. That's when we get those 50-mile-an-hour blows where the snow comes. And now, we haven't had anything quite kind of like that. This year, we just kind of had this creeping thing where the jet stream dipped down and we got cold. Cold, cold, cold. -7 here. You know, we haven't seen -7 days in a row of negative temperatures in years. But I can remember them. Now, I'll be 61 in February. I've got a lot of stuff under my belt. My mom is going to be 85 in February. She remembers a lot more than I do, and she can tell you, go back and say, well, this year it was this temperature, this year it was that temperature, you know.
To the chagrin of most of our listeners.
Yes.
But Chuck, we can predict the weather sometimes, but we can't control the weather. Sort of like what's happening in D.C. I think that there's an analogy there that, and I think a lot of people are feeling this now because, you know, like I said, with climate change, if you want to use those terminologies for politics, you know, the weather, the atmosphere, the environment, the climate has all changed in D.C. because of Donald Trump. Matter of fact, I'm looking at a Wall Street Journal article here that headline, 1 year in, Trump has broken all the rules. And the tagger, populist president has scrambled conventional wisdom on every level with mixed policy results. Well, if some of the policy results that he's had in this first year are what they consider mixed, I hope he keeps mixing into year two and following.
Yeah,
because it's been pretty doggone good as far as I know, coming from the pro-life perspective. The whole thing about he first comes in, they immediately deal reinstating the Mexico City policy to say that we can't use foreign aid money to perform abortions, then pushing the button, trying to get Planned Parenthood defunded, although Congress has been kind of slow and dragging their feet at that because, well, they want to try to position things for their best advantage, which brings me to the reason why we're recording on Thursday, that tomorrow, which will be yesterday when you hear this,
yes.
The president's doing something that stirs it up even more, because for the first time in history, Chuck, and of course the history going back to, I think, like President Nixon, because that's when this whole thing got started after Roe v. Wade, was that we have the annual March for Life, where a lot of pro-lifers from around the country go to D.C. And basically, as you know, and I'm sitting here on Thursday morning, so you know I'm not going to D.C. because I don't go to March for Life. Because I don't like the idea of basically giving a free prop to my opposition. I don't like, because as you know, historically, what's happened is you see these pictures from March for Life, and unless you're just looking at pro-life media, when you're looking at the general media, what do you see, Chuck? You're seeing all of these people with these signs, keep abortion legal, or keep your hands off my body. It's the Pink Hat Brigade. It's the Planned Parenthood NARAL crowd, the Rena crowds, that are getting all the media attention. And why give your opponent free media if you can keep from it? Now, I understand, and I've heard arguments about networking, getting young people involved, showing that we care, encouraging our politicians. And again, there are some of the members of Congress who are in it for the right reasons. And you got guys like Jim Jordan here in Ohio who will basically open their doors of their offices and invite the pro-lifers in and have coffee and drinks and, you know, hot chocolate coffee, that kind of thing. They're not serving alcohol.
Yeah, right.
But they'll have coffee, drink, they'll have donuts and things of that nature, and then they'll meet the staff or Jim himself, if he's available. We'll sit and talk and meet with the pro-lifers because he's one of us. You know, that's his DNA. He wants to end abortion like we do. But then you've got many of them who basically, and I can think of guys like John Boehner and others in the past, who basically use that kind of an event as more of a way to ingratiate themselves with the movement so that they can continue to count on them voting for them back home, but then really never do anything. And Rob Portman's name comes up immediately when I think about that in Ohio, who really never do anything to move the agenda. And it's funny because just announced this week by some of the groups, Susan B. Anthony lists, National Right to Life, you know, the big national groups who oftentimes are more institutionalized than they are actually acting as loyal opposition to some of this nonsense, announced that, oh, it's wonderful, we're going to have all of these policies are going to be voted on this week. And I'm thinking to myself, do you not see, or are you just being complicit in the idea that the only reason why they're actually voting on or casting votes on these certain issues is A, because it's a way to prop themselves up with you guys while you're there, and B, once you leave, then those bills will all of a sudden get tangled up in, well, we couldn't come to an agreement, or we needed to get 60 votes and we can't, you know, we can't reach out to the Democrats, and so therefore nothing happens. But they'll campaign on that vote that really doesn't get you any farther down the road, except for the fact that you can say, ooh, hey, because remember, the House repealed Obamacare 47 times before Pat Tiberi had the chance of actually repealing it and then balked.
And balked, yeah. Well, this
and
is also
going to have, and we've talked about that before, but that's what you're going to have here too. So I usually say, okay, folks, by the time you go to D.C. and you either get on the bus or you drive out or fly out and you get a hotel, or if even if you do a day trip, and you drive and you fly back or come back at the same time, you're probably spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 a person, and that's a conservative estimate. That isn't, you know, you count food and everything else, time off from work, whatever it takes. My thought is we would do an awful lot more of moving the ball down the road to ending abortion and changing the environment, not just the politicians, but the public environment. If we took that 400 by, if you think about it, Chuck, if there's a million people who show up in D.C. for this march and they spend $400 average ahead to get there, that's $400 million. If that $400 million was turned, and of course that's $400 million they're spending to give Planned Parenthood and NARAL free media attention. If they would turn and instead say, you know what? Here's how we're going to recognize the March for Life. We're going to march down to our local pregnancy care center. We're going to march down to our local abstinence education group. We're going to march down to our local pro-life adoption organization. And we're going to write them a check for $400 per person. Because that's what we would spend to go to D.C. And I think that if pregnancy care centers and pro-family groups like adoption organizations, or the folks who teach abstinence until marriage in the schools, like Relationship Under Construction, who I know you're on the board of, Chuck.
Right.
I do believe that what you're going to find is that we're going to end abortion an awful lot quicker than traipsing out to D.C. to basically be a prop for a bunch of politicians who really don't do anything except ceremonial votes, knowing that they can cast that vote, go run on it, put it on their literature, and then never have to answer for it because it's never going to finalize for them. But this year is a little bit different. This year, first time in history, Chuck, and again, since in history, I mean since 1973 when this whole thing started, a sitting president of the United States is going to personally address the March for Life. That's right. Donald Trump, Mr. Let's stir it up. Let's do things as let's break the rules.
Yes.
Is personally going to address the pro-life march for the March for Life. Now, again, folks, think about this. This didn't happen under pro-life President George Bush. This didn't happen under pro-life President George Bush Sr., who I don't even know. I don't even think is pro-life. This didn't happen under pro-life President Ronald Reagan. This certainly didn't happen under Gerald Ford or Richard Nixon. Okay? This is the first time a sitting president has actually going to basically give his reputation and influence to the pro-life community, specifically, directly, publicly. That's a major shift. And that, and you talk about creating waves in D.C., that's going to create some waves.
Oh, yeah, it is.
You know, so some of these votes, and of course, there one of the bills that has is supposedly keyed up for a vote if National Right to Life can get out of the way and stop opposing it, is Heartbeat, the federal Heartbeat bill, which is modeled after Ohio's Heartbeat bill that we're trying to get passed in Ohio. You know, I got to give kudos to Janet Porter and the folks at Faith to Action, and because they went to D.C. while we're working here in Ohio trying to get it through Ohio, they decided to go to D.C. and they had Steve King introduce their bill. It's House Resolution 490. We've got like 170 co-sponsors, and it looks like it may get marked up for a vote. However, and they've been pushing to get people to contact Congress because National Right to Life Committee, the group that can't get out of its own way, isn't supporting it. Now, they'll support the Born Alive Infant Protection Act, and the Pain Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which are their pieces of legislation, which basically the one is if you're trying to have an abortion and, like, say, a partial birth and the child actually comes out and it's born, you can't then kill it after it's left to die in a utility closet at the clinic, which has happened before a number of times.
It still happens.
These pieces of legislation are bad. I'm just saying they're missing the mark somewhat. And, of course, the 20-week ban says, you know, since the unborn child may be able to feel pain at 20 weeks, then we should say that we can't take their life by abortion. But, hey, if you're under 20, if you're 19 weeks and 6 days, you get that baby can be ripped apart limb by limb, and we'll say that that's okay and perfectly legal. Now, they won't say that they'd say it's okay, but that's by implication what they're saying. Whereas heartbeat, it says if you find a detectable heartbeat, which means that the baby is actually alive, and that happens very early on in pregnancy, then it's complete
ban. A few weeks.
You can't touch the baby.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we can't have that because that defeats the 100-year plan.
Yeah, exactly. And I understand from the other side, there are some purists who are basically saying, well, then what about from conception to the point the heart starts beating? Well, we want to protect those children, too, but we need to get there. I'll be the first one who will be on board a Life of Conception Act or a Personhood Act. And, you know, and I'll fight tooth and nail for it. But we have to stop doing the minimalist things that we can do because we're wringing our hands about how the courts are going to respond, and we need to challenge it. I mean, Donald Trump is not sitting there wringing his hands about how Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell are going to respond to initiatives he does. And I think that's the big mixing it up, breaking the rules thing is he's acting like a CEO. He's like, you do your job, I'll do my job. I'll go sell. If you do something that works, I'll go sell it. And if you don't, I'm going to come in and I'm going to have a little key leaders meeting, and I'm going to basically ask your divisions why you're not performing the way we need you to perform. This is something that hasn't happened in D.C. in a long time. As a matter of fact, probably ever. You've had military leaders, you've had politicos, you've had ex-state officials. This is the first time, I think, in history that you've had a pure businessman who's basically been the president of the United States, and it's starting to show.
Yes.
And I think that that's going to be, and again, you're going to be talking about here in a minute, one of the other things where the politicos thought they had it all lined out. They thought they all were set up to basically get it back to business as usual, get rid of this shaking things up and breaking the rules and getting back to, we're going to set the rules on you. Oops, I don't think it's going to work that way for them. How about you, Chuck?
Well, before we go into that, I want to talk. You raised the point about wringing their hands over the judiciary.
Yes.
Finally, with Donald Trump sitting in the presidency, we're starting to get some people who are thinking constitutionally. Finally, after decades of, well, we can't do this because of the courts, we can't do... We're thinking constitutionally about the courts. We're seeing articles where people are starting to think constitutionally about the courts and what can be done about runaway courts. Now, what am I talking about? Well, there's an article in the American Thinker, and I sent it to you and said, who's crazy now? Because when you and I used to talk about this very same thing, people would look at us like we had carrots growing out of our ears, and they would say things like, you guys don't seem to understand how this works. And we would always reply, well, it's actually you who doesn't understand how this works. We would be called crazy. Essentially, end judicial tyranny with one single word is the name of this article. What's going on in this article? Well, since the election of President Trump, I'm reading from the article, we have witnessed a series of rulings by Clinton and Obama-appointed federal judges to block executive orders related to immigration. In each case, the current system has allowed a single unelected judge to block the actions of a duly elected president who has attempted to exercise the authority conferred upon him by the Constitution and the voters. Such judicial tyranny cannot be tolerated. Okay, we're fine up to that point. The only court created by the founders of the Constitution is the Supreme Court.
That's absolutely correct.
With all other federal courts established by Congress and administered by the judicial branch of government. District courts, appellate courts, and the various circuits are all congressional initiatives, and that includes tax court, regulatory courts, all those things. Federal judges are nominated by the executive branch but confirmed by the congressional arm of government. Throughout the history of the Republic, the appointment of judges by party and power has been an ongoing effort to seed individuals of their own political philosophy. If you don't understand that, then you don't understand why John Marshall was the second Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and why he was there. He was there to destroy the Jeffersonian idea of state sovereignty and replace it with the nationalistic hopes of the Federalist Party. That's the bottom line. And it's interesting to note that John Marshall and Thomas Jefferson, who was a state sovereignty guy, were cousins, and they could not stand the sight of one another. Okay, when the parties were each more centrist, the process was somewhat less contentious. But as the left drifted further from the Constitution, using the concept of it being a living document, the divides have widened. And that, folks, that goes back to the 1800s. That goes back to the 19th century. The living document concept. Oliver Wendell Holmes and Felix Frankfurter and the progeny thereof. We have now have a cadre of Obama-appointed far-left judges who are prepared to exercise their political ideology over their sworn constitutional duties. Okay, that's the setup. Essentially, there is talk of resolving the situation by appointing strict constitutionalist judges, as Trump is now doing, and quote-unquote packing the court. That's called packing the court by the left. Dilution yes. would be a better term for the sitting liberals. Will still enjoy their lifetime appointments, and it is axiomatic that impeachment has all been impossible. Requiring two-thirds of the Senate to agree. That's one of the problems with impeachment. If everybody understood that the Constitution is there, impeachment is a power you can use against judges, and yes, we should be impeaching judges. Normally, they save that for judges who are obviously corrupt and taking bribes to come across with certain decisions and that kind of thing. That's not really the point. The point is, if you've got a judge who violates the law, the written law of the Constitution, he should be removed from office. But Congress is reluctant to do that.
Right. You know, and I know the author talks about this definitional change of that word.
Yes.
But, you know, and as I mentioned to you offline when we were first looking at it, I said, yeah, I can see that. Although, like with, you know, because if you look at that section of the Constitution and right. the judiciary section,
Article 3,
it also
section
talks
two.
About ambassadors yeah. and consuls.
Yes.
My concern about that is that there may be a temptation by either Congress or the court itself to limit the scope of that phrase of public ministers. If Congress were to add the president and the vice president to say that that includes public ministers of that stripe, whereas I think currently the reading are more of our foreign ambassadors and our trade right. representatives yes. and those people.
Yeah.
But if you add president VP, that the court could limit that scope of the impact of that section of the Constitution, as they're wont to do, to just decisions affecting trade relations or foreign matters. So it wouldn't be on whether or not the like a domestic issue, because, you know, you've got this whole issue right now of, oh, we try to spin that Trump's doing this and that's bad. And they're all setting up. And we'll talk about this a little bit later, but they're all setting up for trying to get to this thing of where they can actually goad enough people into wanting to try to bring articles of impeachment, which I don't think is going to happen because I think he outsmarts them every time. And I think it's hilarious. But the point is, you and I have talked about this, too, that it's also within the purview of Congress, not just to change the definition of this word, but to also dissolve any court under the Supreme Court.
Exactly. Now,
as you said, the Supreme Court is the only court set up by the Constitution. All the other courts are under the jurisdiction of Congress. And so, therefore, Congress could basically say, okay, Ninth Circuit, we're dissolving you. We're going to get rid of all the judges in the Ninth Circuit. We're going to reconstitute and we're going to make it like a different circuit, or we're going to take this state and roll it into this circuit and these two states, and they're going to go over into this circuit. And they can do that. I mean, they can remove a judge by impeachment, but it's so much cleaner and easier. Just get rid of a district or get rid of a circuit and reconstitute it and appoint new judges.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you for your service, guys. You're no longer needed here. That your circuit no longer exists.
Right, exactly, because if there's not a job to go to, then you don't have a job.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really what it gets down to.
And the fact is that the Congress can do that. They could immediately reset and go back to zero. Now, what would that create? That would create a serious problem in that, if you think about it, it would create lawsuit problems. There's all kinds of lawsuits filed in circuit courts. If the circuit doesn't exist anymore, the filing doesn't exist.
Exactly.
So you would create a little bit of chaos by doing that. Could you catch up? Yeah, because you're starting with a clean docket. You're just like, you appoint new people, and they would take a look at a lot of these frivolous suits and just say, we're not taking that. We're going to refile, and we're dismissed out of hand.
Yep.
So there are all kinds of things that can be done. I like the idea. Now, these guys are on the right track, but again, this is just a step in the right direction. They're trying to be too clever by half by changing the meaning of the word of public ministers. That's essentially what the article is about. Okay, step in the right direction, but the real, you've sort of missed the forest for the trees here. Since these courts are under the jurisdiction of Congress, they're also forgetting that in this same clause, Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, there's the ability to limit jurisdiction of the courts except in certain places. And that is what they're talking about. Ambassadors, other public ministers, consuls, in cases where the states are a party. The Supreme Court has original jurisdiction. If you'll recall, during the whole Obamacare thing, the great John Roberts, who was supposed to be the savior for conservatives, ha 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 ha, basically came out and announced that if the states were going to sue over Obamacare, the Supreme Court would not hear the case until it had gone through the appeals process. In other words, or a district, circuit, and then Supreme Court. In fact, the Constitution says they can't refuse to hear the case. They have to hear it because the states are a party to the suit. And they have original jurisdiction, according to the Constitution. In other words, the Supreme Court cannot say you have to go through the appeals process. The Supreme Court can say, okay, we have to hear this case. What could Congress have done? They could have sat there and said, no, you can't do that. You have to hear the case. Now, what's the solution if they refuse to hear the case? Impeachment.
Impeachment, absolutely.
You violated the written law of the United States of America, which is the Constitution. You have to hear the case. You either have to hear the case or you are losing your job. Now, people say that's harsh, and that means that the judiciary isn't really independent because you're forcing them to do something they don't want to do. That's right. It's called checks and balances. An independent judiciary is a dangerous thing. That's why they're supposed to be underneath checks and balances. And the checks and balances are all based on the written law, which is the Constitution. That's why I like this article. When you brought this up, you know, about wringing your hands over the judiciary, the reason that pro-lifers wring their hands over this is, and many of them do not understand it, is because the Congress refuses to take its authority to check and balance the courts.
Well, absolutely. Now, here's the other problem, Chuck, and this leads right into what we're talking about here. I've got two different articles. One's from Reuters, and the other one is from NBC News, and they're both headlines fairly similarly. But, you know, in the light of all of this and what we've just been talking about, it really is, this is the snapshot of what the problem is in our government. And the headline out of the Reuters news is, Republicans in the U.S. Congress rush to gain support to avoid shutdown. And, of course, the NBC News takes it a little bit farther. Nervous Republicans fear they'll pay if government shuts down. Chuck, this is the biggest problem we have in the federal government. And that is, you have a president who is breaking the rules and stirring things up and changing things around, and who's actually being even more successful had he not been dealing with a Republican majority in Congress led by Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, who basically are scared of their own shadows and worried to death to the point that they're willing to give the store to their political opposition. Well, and I say that with tongue in cheek, because you and I both know that that may not be nearly as big a polarity as they'd like to people to believe it is.
Exactly.
But to give away all of the policy positioning and all of the wins to the Democrats. And of course, and Mitch McConnell is, you know, infamous for this kind of thing of, well, we just can't get to 60 votes. We just can't. Well, OK, use the what they call the nuclear option, which is totally misnamed. So the constitutional option, and basically get it to where you just need 50 votes and get it down and get it done. And this is all on this deferred action for childhood arrivals thing, Chuck. And I know you've been looking at this, so I'll walk us through this. Walk us through why the Republicans are scared to death of this little proposal.
Well, they're scared to death because they're essentially scared to death of the press. This is the dumbest thing, honestly. Donald Trump has been able to demonstrate that the fear of the press is essentially, the press is a will of the wisp. Yes, the old saying, never do battle with people who buy ink by the barrel. Well, yes, that's true, but we live in a new media age. And the Republicans are still thinking that we're working in the 1980s, when essentially if CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN all came out against you, and the Washington Post and the Boston Globe and the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times came out against you, you were sunk. Do we live in that age now, Barry?
No, we don't. Matter of fact, I think the vast majority of people, and again, this is something that you can thank Trump for. You know, he just came out with this whole idea of doing the fake news awards because he's going to minimize the impact or the importance of these establishment, you know, beating news organs like the New York Times and the Washington Post through ridicule. Basically, I'll have to laugh about it, but he's using Alinsky tactics on the Alinsky
Act. Exactly. Exactly. He has turned their own fire hose against them. The fact is that, and you've got senators who purported themselves to be and ran as conservatives who have been exposing them their true colors. I think of Bob Corker in Tennessee. I think of Jeff Flake in Arizona. Any number of other ones. And by the way, Jeff Flake came unglued on Wednesday on the floor of the Senate to a nearly empty Senate chamber, which is part of the thing that made this meaningless. Jeff Flake came unglued and essentially accused Donald Trump of being like Joseph Stalin for being critical of the press. Well, you know, does Donald Trump have the right to be critical of the press? What has the press been doing to Donald Trump since right after he announced that he was running for president? The fact is, they have been trying to politically assassinate him, and I say politically assassinate him, since 2015, treating his candidacy as a joke, treating his election, he's never going to get elected. Hillary's obviously the shoe-in. This is going to be a landslide. Oops, not so much. The fact is that Jeff Flake came unglued and essentially showed why Jeff Flake had to withdraw and not run again for the United States Senate, because he was going to have his head politically handed to him by the voters of Arizona. He chose not to run because he knew he was not going to win. Why is he not going to win? Because Arizonans are sick and tired of having to kowtow to illegal immigrants in their state who are running kidnap murder rings in southern Arizona, who are running drugs across the border, who are running illegal aliens across the border and leaving them to die in the desert. This is why Jeff Flake cannot walk away from his owners and the groups like the United States Chamber of Commerce, who essentially want cheap labor to the point that they are willing to give the store away to illegals, who are also on this DACA thing, which is really the sticking point on why the government may shut down. Well, what is the DACA thing? The Democrats will not acquiesce to a continuing budget resolution as long as there's not protection for people who have entered the country illegally in it. They want a blanket amnesty. They don't just want protection for people who came with their parents or as youngsters and are still here. That's another discussion. They want blanket amnesty. Everybody who's here illegally should get path to citizenship, period. And if they can't get it, then they're going to stop the budget process. That's the bottom line here. And that's why Jeff Flake, a Republican, is coming out and arguing in favor of Democratic ideals, Democrat Party ideals. And that is open borders, forget protections for American workers. I have no trouble with immigration. I want to make that clear. And I don't care where they come from. I'm not going to fall into this trap about, well, we only want people from here and here and here and here. But we don't want people to come here whose main goal is to get on our relief system. That is what Trump was talking about when he made the comments that have been so explosive over the last week. He's tired of people coming here and working their way onto the welfare rolls on a permanent basis. That's what he meant when he made that comment that we're not going to talk, we're not going to mention the words that were used. That particular phrase, though, hit a resonant note because people know exactly what he was talking about. And that was it. Now, I've heard people like Al Mohler, who made the ridiculous statement. He jumped over a logical chasm and made it sound like Donald Trump was making a racial statement. No, he was not making a racial statement. He said all the countries he was talking about had people of color in them. No, that's not true. Because those kinds of countries include places in Europe, places all from all over the world, places in Asia, places in Africa, places in Central America, places in South America, all of which contain not African and not necessarily Asian, but contain white people. And we know what that's all about. But has the press attempted to assassinate him over that? Well, yes, they did. That particular talk was not even supposed to leave that room because it was a closed-door discussion with legislators. And here's the deal. You had legislators in there who hate the idea of not giving blanket amnesty. Therefore, they got together, Republican and Democrat, to report on a statement that was made, which I'm sure that Donald Trump thought was under the auspices of being in a closed meeting and therefore not available to the media. Now, is that the kind of talk he should have been saying? No, I will admonish him. That is not the kind of language you should be using in a political discussion about these kinds of issues. Does it necessarily mean he was talking racially? No, he was not. This has nothing to do with color. It has to do with attitude. We want people to come here who want to use the opportunity to better themselves and our nation at the same time, not people who want to come here and better themselves at the expense of the American taxpayer. That's the difference.
Yep.
And what are people like the Democratic Party trying to do and some Republicans? They want to create a permanently dependent voter base because they know that if you create a permanently dependent voter base, people will continue to vote for that party to get more stuff. And that's the battle you're seeing happening in the Republican Party right now. It's the people who want to help create a permanent voter base and then compete for those that permanent voter base who's going to vote itself more stuff, and people who want to vote to keep motivation of continuing to improve oneself as an individual, not take welfare. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
So that's,
but, you know, that's not how DC runs.
No, of course not. No, they
which is the reason why the Republicans are sitting there moaning and groaning about this potential of not being able to hand the store over to the left. And, you know, I think Trump's basically like, he's like, you know, this is ridiculous. It's hurting us. You know, it's causing problems. We're tracing, you know, some of these people who are supposedly, you know, this deferred action for childhood arrivals. It's like, yeah, they arrived in childhood, but now they're adults and they're committing adult crimes in this country. Many of them are, many of them aren't, but many of them are.
A very large larger percentage than the normal population.
Exactly. And so, you know, it's time to stop this. You know, let's get back to straightening out our immigration, and I think that's what he's getting at. But, of course, the Democrats are you know, going to demagogue it, and the Republicans, who are scared to death about, you know, the government shutdown. Well, you and I talked about this before. I don't think it'd be all that bad if the government shut down, but I think the main reason why the puppies are really worried about it is not the midterm elections. It's that people might actually start seeing, well, wait a minute, we don't need this stuff in government. You know, yeah, you shut down, I didn't miss it. National parks, didn't miss it. Blah, 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 didn't miss it. You know, there are going to be those things where they're going to be like, yeah, you know what, let's reorganize priorities.
Here's the
bad
part.
If the government shuts down, I think what's going to happen is it's going to give the Trump administration an opportunity to be able to review some of these programs and say, well, when we start back up, we're just not going to continue these.
Yeah.
And that really is where the Republicans are having a nightmare fit about shutting the government.
Well, there's another one, and that is that the press will come out and blame it on the Republicans. And the Republicans are like, no. That's not the way. This is on the Democrats. They're the ones who are holding up the entire budget process over something that the American people have made clear that they do not want.
Right. Exactly. But the problem is that the Democrats are doing this because they know they can, because they've got guys, and it's interesting, in this article from NBC News, you look at the very bottom of it, there's a quote, Ohio Representative Steve Stivers, chairman of the House Republicans campaign arm, refused to entertain the possibility of inaction. Quote, I feel confident that we will not shut the government down and that there will be a DACA fix before March. I feel confident enough that both are going to happen that I don't even consider the other option, which is a shutdown or deportations when the program ends. So there is the campaign arm, Ohio's own Steve Stivers, basically handing over to Democrats, you guys run the show, you tell us what to do.
Well, the fact is there's almost for certain going to be at least some form of DACA. But it depends on what form of DACA. Now, if you make it so that those who came by no fault of their own with their parents, if they can prove, the way it ought to work is, okay, no welfare benefits at all. This is how Switzerland has done it. Any time that you take welfare payments in Switzerland, they have a path in that immigrants can come in and apply for citizenship after a certain amount of time. But if they've taken welfare, they are now eligible to ever apply for citizenship, period. If you go on relief, you have made yourself ineligible. Second of all, if you engage in any kind of criminal activity, you are deported and your path to citizenship is closed off. Permanently. You want to see that crime rate, the higher crime rate from DACA changing? You make that part of the picture and you make it stick. Is that going to happen? I'd like to see it happen. And we could force it to happen as individuals if we get with our representatives, because I think DACA is going to happen. And again, I think if it's in the right form, it's not necessarily horrible. You know, we do need some immigration in this country. Let's be clear about that.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is the Republicans are taking this opportunity and squandering it by basically handing over the talking points and the control of this to their opposition.
Well,
because they're afraid of a bad day in the press, which to them, in their mind, equals getting killed at the polls. And that's because they don't show any backbone. And so when you don't show backbone, you demoralize your base. And once you demoralize your base, then what you've done is created a scenario to where even the smallest amount of opposition turnout spells the end of your political career.
I listened to an interview with a congressman who's a member of the Freedom Caucus last night, a Representative Gozer from Arizona. And he made a point that I thought was an excellent point. He goes, why should the base trust the Republican Party? He said, trust is a series of kept promises.
Mm-hmm.
That's the basis of trust. What do we have from the Republican leadership? A series of unkept promises. These guys got themselves reelected and with a large majority behind the Trump wave, in 2016 by promising a wall, promising to eliminate DACA, promising to eliminate chain migration, promising to get the whole immigration problem under control. And that includes guys like John McCain. And what's the first thing they're doing now? They're chucking it. They're giving the keys to the government, which they got through hard-fought battles, in election battles in 2016. They're handing the keys over to the Democrats and saying, here, you drive. That's the problem.
That's what it's getting down to.
Yeah, that has been your point. That I've been sort of like talking around, but yeah.
No, that's okay.
And it's good because you get to reiterate it because you're more articulate than I am in that area. But that being said, that's exactly what's going on. Here's the keys. You drive. Well, it's time. If the Republicans don't want to get thrown out of power, and I'm not so sure that they want to maintain power. I think that they got so used to being the opposition party in the 40-plus years that they were out of power, from the 1950s until the 1990s, that they don't like being in control. They don't like being in charge. It's too much responsibility.
Oh, okay, well, Chuck, I'm gonna throw another iron on this fire and stoke it up pretty hot.
Good.
Because I don't so know so much that it's that they were so far long out of power that they've forgotten how to do it. I think it's the fact that in order for you to be successful, in order for you to win, in order for you to actually show leadership, you have to have a foundation of beliefs and principles that you will not change for anything.
Yes.
That's the success of the left. Okay, let's just be quite honest. As much as we hate what they believe it. And it is a guiding principle for them, and they will do anything that's necessary in order to advance those principles. And they will not capitulate on those principles. They will not subsume those principles to the immediate. The Republicans, by and large, can't say that. A handful can. Guys like Jim Jordan, I'm going to point him out again. But you got guys like Stivers and others who just can't, because they don't have those base principles. Now, we're seeing it at the federal level. We're about to see it at the state level here again, too.
Good segue. Yes.
I don't know how much time we've got left for this, but folks, you got to pay attention because there's a major threat coming. It's called House Bill 160. It's a bill to basically force the people of the state of Ohio to have to accept lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, blah, 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 I mean, the whole alphabet soup, to put those, shall we say, psychological and sexual deviancy practices as a civil right. That means that if you are an employer or you rent a house or you have a business, you are going to be subject to fines, etc., if you are accused of, now again, because we know that once you're accused, then you're guilty in this culture, if you're accused of being discriminatory toward these folks. Now, there's two versions of this bill. The House Bill 160 is the one that's probably going to get some traction, but there's a companion bill in the Senate Bill 100, that's kind of worse, because it actually talks about having to craft educational programs for schools to talk about the history of or the genesis of prejudice. And you know where that's going to go, Chuck.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But the point is that we've been fighting this kind of bill off in Ohio for at least a dozen years. I've been involved in this. For the first time, it was just announced yesterday on Wednesday. For the first time in all the years that the liberal, Democrat, progressive, homosexualist left has tried to get this bill through, they now have what they consider to be their fait accompli. They have convinced the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. You mentioned the Chamber of Commerce nationally before, Chuck.
Yeah.
They've convinced the Ohio Chamber of Commerce to endorse this horrible policy. And again, there's nothing more. Like I said, the only two people that Republican members of the elected officials in the legislature, they, if they don't have their own principles, they first follow leadership whatever that looks like. Yeah. In this cycle, it doesn't look that good. And then they follow the Ohio Chamber of Commerce, because that's who writes big campaign checks to them. So, you know, my thought is that the chamber had stayed out of this, and actually I think it opposed it at one point. But now all of a sudden, because they've got all these companies where, you know, they've created these diversity panels and all of these things, they've had enough of the big boys come in at the chamber that they've pushed the change, and the chamber now is endorsing this ridiculous, expansion of special rights for people based upon who they decide to sleep with and have deviant sex with.
Yeah, here the bottom,
or mutilate their bodies in order to say I'm a woman trapped in a guy's body or vice versa. This is nuts. But the problem is, with the chamber now coming out in support of it, we're going to have a fight on our hands, because a lot of these Republican members are going to hide behind the chamber's money.
Exactly.
And they're going to vote for this.
Exactly. And remember that
though this is a bill that has been introduced and pushed by liberal Democrats who want nothing better than to remove these people from office, and has no Republican co-sponsors, but the Republican majority is continuing. They're actually there's an announcement that sometime either this month or next, they're going to continue hearings. They gave this bill a hearing back in June of last year after it was introduced, because you got to give bills one hearing if they're introduced before like the second year of the 2 year session. And so we thought that, you know, back in June that was going to be a one and out, but now because the chamber has jumped in, they're now talking about scheduling more hearings for this bill, which is again introduced by a Democrat, co-sponsored by only Democrats in the legislature, and going into a committee where the Democrats are outnumbered by the Republicans 8-4. But yet, because the Chamber of Commerce is the Republicans, shall we say, sugar daddy, they may try to pass this garbage piece of legislation out, because honestly, it isn't just the chamber. It's John Kasich. Kasich has wanted these special protections because of campaign promises that he's been making and things that he's been doing behind the scenes with key advisors who happen to be, and it's no secret, and it's actually been published in the media, are openly homosexual.
Yep.
That's what we're dealing with right now. Honestly, I'd love to see John Kasich step down and leave, and that would probably shut the chamber up on this particular issue and get it back to a sense of normalcy, because if this bill passes, it's going to have some major negative repercussions for churches, for schools, for Christian businesses.
Yep.
It's a major problem, and I think it's something that we don't need to be doing in Ohio. It's a waste of time, and it's a waste of focus.
So HB 160, write your congressman, or get a hold of your state legislator and ask him to kill it. Vote no.
Absolutely.
And SB 100 as well. Kill it. All right.
Right. S-100's likely not going to go very far, but the House version is the one we have to worry about.
Yeah, okay. HB 160, we want that killed. Okay, that being said, remember that the training ground for the feds is at the state level. Keep that in mind and let them know you're not going any further if you vote for this thing, because I don't want you at the federal level doing this kind of thing. That's how you get at these guys, because there are a lot of them, a large percentage of them, are thinking someday about Congress or maybe the Senate. So you get under their skin by mentioning the fact that you're not going to sit by while they do that. Now, along kind of the same line, the group that you mentioned earlier that I'm on the board of, Relationships Under Construction. Relationships Under Construction is an abstinence teaching group. We are Christian-based, although we don't you can't directly bring that into the public schools. We have a lot of public schools where we're science-based. We show students why it's a good idea, why they will have their health and their well-being for the rest of their lives will be, and their income will be affected for the rest of their lives if they engage in premarital sex and a number of other things and get STDs and that kind of thing. And we're having our annual banquet, our annual fundraising banquet. It'll be, I believe, at the Villa Milano on March 8th. March 8th. We would like you to come and sit at our table. I don't know if Barry's going to be able to be there this year, but I would like for you to come and sit at my table with me. if you could contact us at www.principledpolicy.com, principledpolicy.com, and you can sign up to sit at our table here with me. And you're going to learn how exactly what the teachers are teaching, because that's what the presentation is this year, what the teachers teach and the statistics behind all of it. So it's actually a very exciting time. I'd love for you to come and be my guest at the Relationships Under Construction Banquet March 8th at the Villa Milano. That being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com, and join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.